Good morning and welcome back to the Counselor's Cafe, where we focus on the care and feeding of the mind, the psyche, the spirit, talking about whatever it is that makes us human, the psychology of being human, the philosophy that we create for ourselves, conscious of ourselves, and what is consciousness. We're on this ongoing conversation of the nature of existence, so we also look at what does it mean to be conscious, to be self-aware. Capable of change. Are we capable of change? Or are we always preconditioned? These are the kind of questions that we make. And are we free to make choices? Or are we all preconditioned and just responding to stimuli? Anyway, a little psychology, a little philosophy, and maybe a little bit of something else. Yes. So that is our brand new mic. It should be mic 3. So say something to us.
This is definitely, are. I am now here. And
so all your pithy remarks.
Yeah, all my pithy remarks will be recorded in posterity forever.
Okay.
BS, yes, that's, well, without that, topsoil would be depleted.
Okay, we got that one in there. And
I write these down, folks.
Anyway, as I was saying, this is a continuing conversation as with this morning with Paul. It's been in the last couple of weeks, and we have someone else who's going to help us this morning, and that's Rocco. Hello.
Yeah, you probably know him as Mr. Music on Saturday mornings.
Absolutely.
Yes.
First of all, it's a pleasure to be here, Audrey. It really is. And I've had both of you on my show a number of times, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Mm-hmm. And to help us out. With our conversation, our ongoing conversation.
Got these microphones going.
Yes.
Yes, that was a great thing in itself.
We'll have to check that one. I don't know why that one's not working. But anyway, I'll have to check it before this afternoon. I'm a push to the community today to understand that we want you to call in and be involved in our community conversation. It's 929-9601. We're here with the door open. The door is open telephone-wise, and if you ever want to come in and get on the air with us, just call up and let us know, and the door will be open, and you can give us your thoughts. Don't be afraid to hop in and think.
If you happen to be over near Weaver Street and just walk across the street and tap on the door, maybe if you look okay, we might open the door for you.
That's right.
And give you an open mic.
Uh-huh.
As long as you keep it relatively clean, we'll let you talk.
Absolutely. We have to keep it to the FCC rules and regulations, as well
That's
as
right.
WCOM's very high standards of behavior.
That's right.
Okay. Paul is the host of Touchstones here at WCOM on Tuesdays at 11 a.m. And Rocco, of course, does Saturday Morning Music Hall, which means it's the sign that it's the weekend when you get Rocco on. Today we're going to be talking about what is essential and what is existential. And I will, as again, invite you to join in the discussion. Hop in. Don't be afraid that you're going to be rude by interrupting somebody.
This is the time to dredge up your introductory.
He interrupts me all the time.
To dredge up your introductory philosophy courses. Or maybe you never took an introductory philosophy course. This is a good time to pontificate about what you think existentialism might be.
Absolutely. If you can't call right now, you can always get in touch later by emailing counselorscafe@nc.rr.com or by writing to Counselor, Box 6, 200 West Weaver Street in Carrboro. And while I'm talking about getting in touch, check out WCOM's website at www.communityradio.coop. Take our listener survey. Click on the West End Report to let us know what's going on in your neck of the woods. And you can hear us 24/7 anywhere on the planet where there's an internet.
Absolutely, Audrey.
So get involved, and we're going to take just 1 minute and 42 seconds, I think, is how long Feeling Groovy lasts. So with any luck, we're going to play a little Simon and Garfunkel. Okay.
down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy. La-da-da-da-da-da-da, feeling groovy.
Not listening.
Hello, lamppost, what you knowin'? I come to watch your flowers growing. Ain't you got no rhymes for me? Do it and do-do, feeling groovy. Da-da-da-da-da-da, feeling groovy. I got no deeds to do, no promises to keep. I'm dappled and drowsy and ready to sleep. Let the morning time drop all its petals on me. Life, I love you, all is groovy.
Feeling groovy, Monday morning on this beautiful, sunny, sunny Monday morning. And to start off, I'm going to throw something out about essentialist and existentialist. And I have some description of essentialist as being a noun. That things are universal, abstract, unchanging. An existentialist as being verb-like, changing, concrete, particular, active, creative. So I'm throwing that out in our opening discussion of what is existentialism and how does it affect how we govern our lives?
Well, Paul, go ahead.
Well, I think that, yeah, I really have to understand that this essential, existential differentiation is really derivative and goes all the way back to the godson of philosophy, which is Plato. And the essentialist is really a modified version of a Platonic and Aristotelian view, mm-hmm, of what is archetypal.
Mm-hmm.
And archetypes for Plato were something that never embodied, but which caused the world to be the way it was. So basically what we saw as the world, the existent world, was really no more than an image of the real world that didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
It stayed in a sort of suspension between existence and non-existence.
Mm-hmm.
It was not static. That's a derivative meaning from Aristotle, the
mm-hmm
staticness of it.
Mm-hmm.
Aristotle turned around and said, well, the only thing we know is what exists, so that at best universals are conjectures.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Plato saw it the other way around. He said, no, what the real reality that causes existence is the archetypal, and what we think exists out here is all reactive and merely mm-hmm a shadow of the real. And of course the classic view of the cave,
mm-hmm,
which is the wonderful myth in the Republic that everybody remembers. So everybody was thinking that there's a big difference between Plato and Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, but they actually have more in common than they have against each other.
Right.
And there's a synthesis that eventually came up between the two of them, which was called, for the lack of a better term, and not making it over theological, Thomism,
mm-hmm,
based on Thomas Aquinas, who did a nice little synthesis of this. You know, and eventually,
how does that affect the way we look at it? How does it affect the way we think of our lives? You know, I'm coming at this from a psychological viewpoint.
You know, Audrey, getting back to your original question,
mm-hmm,
which was, what's the difference between
essential
and existence? All right.
Essence and existence.
Wouldn't you say, I would say that the question that we're trying to answer is relative, and it's both. It's just mm-hmm. the way you look at it. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you look at the first half of the question in one way, you can come up with an answer and put it in a nice little box and sort of make you happy with it. Mm-hmm. If you look at it from the other angle, I think you can be just as correct. And it you have to look at the factors involved, being that the way you look at that question is going to determine your answer. They're both correct. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see what you're saying on that. And what it makes me jump into is the discussions that are going on in today's physics. And they talk about when you see, look through, to see a particle in these, you know, microscopic little bits and pieces, where they keep trying to look, find the element, the building block of the universe. And what they're finding is it changes
right
as you look at it, depending on how you look at
exactly.
it. Whether you see
everything
a dot
is
or
relative.
Wave.
Everything is relative.
But also that it's a thesis being put out that the act of looking at it actually changes the character or the nature of the thing being looked at.
Yeah, those are two different issues, mm-hmm. though. Mm-hmm. I mean, the issue of one is that you set up the situation to where you're going to see it as a ray, and when you see mm-hmm. it as a ray, you can't understand it as a particle.
Mm-hmm.
And the other way is you see it as a particle, then it doesn't make sense as a ray.
That's what I'm saying.
But they work...
But they're
simultaneous.
Seeing it both.
Right.
It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the viewer, as it were, or the way that we look at it. Now, I really like, and that's an analogy I use all the time that you use, which is basically the two sides of the coin analogy. I love that analogy. I use it endlessly, you know. And when it's sort of like, what we have to think of, though, is that, you know, infinitesimal time, when you're tossing a coin, and that one time out of 100 million, and it does happen, you know, especially if you're tossing nickels, it lands on its side and doesn't flip over to one side or the
uh-huh.
other. Is that possible, and what is that?
Uh-huh.
Well, I would say it's possible.
Sure, it's possible. But what would that be? What would it be like if one were, as it were, living in particle reality here and ray reality here? Mm-hmm. You know, so I got, you know, my brain is working with one side of seeing everything as streams of light, and the other thing is seeing everything in as little points of little spots.
Well, you know, about 40 years ago, I used to teach ninth grade science,
uh-huh.
mm-hmm. and the big question was: is light made up of waves or particles? Uh-huh. And of course,
right.
it's both.
Right.
And for
wavicles,
kids, right?
Yeah,
for,
right.
for kids to grab that concept, it isn't
uh-huh.
easy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but you see, here's the thing, and now actually there is a term for this. I mean, you know, philosophers have come up with a term for this, or not necessarily universally accepted, but if and that very rare instance when the coin lands on its side,
uh-huh.
which we normally don't pay any attention to, then we're stuck in a place of perplexity.
Uh-huh.
And perplexity is that we are constantly in the formulation, the revolution, and the radicalness of questioning,
uh-huh.
and at the same time, a sense of multiplicable applicabilities. And, you know, in terms of literature,
uh-huh.
you know, when you have... if you're reading a novel and suddenly you realize that the novel is talking at different levels,
mm-hmm.
and you see a new level,
mm-hmm.
and then you notice that it's not only talking at that level, but it's talking at a third level,
mm-hmm.
and it's talking at a fourth level. I mean, you know, and you can't hold all the levels necessary simultaneously,
right.
but you can go back and you can see how each one applies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might be this reductive Freudian version, and then there might be another Jungian version, and then there might be another sort of Rankian version, and then another. All of these different versions of that all sort of apply in the same narrative line. That's sort of like holding these different questions or answers. Mm-hmm. They all apply, and yet neither... neither controls the other, But what I think we're talking about when we talk about, you know, essence and existence, mm-hmm. is we're sort of saying, what is causative? In other words,
is it the action of actions doing it? I'm thinking.
Action is a way of understanding cause.
Right. All right, Paul and Audrey, how would this fit in to this equation we're talking about? We're all pretty familiar with the famous philosopher Descartes, mm-hmm, who mm-hmm. stated, "I think, therefore I am."
Mm-hmm.
Now, he probably wrote that, 700 or 800 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
When did Descartes live?
Was it 1500, 1600?
Yeah.
It was 600 years ago.
Uh-huh.
But if you start with that and build forward, it's a pretty profound statement.
But we were talking not too long ago about Fenning's affect, imagery, consciousness, and it's saying, in a way, I am, therefore I think.
Or you could even twist it around in another way, going back to mm-hmm. what, you know, everything is the way you look at
right.
it. As far as reality and relativity, you could say, maybe I think, therefore maybe I am.
Yes.
You know,
and
there's all different ways of twisting everything.
Well, there's no maybe about me thinking. There's no maybe about me thinking. You know, I'm not thinking at all. I'm just talking here. This is just talk. No think. No thought behind this talk whatsoever.
929-9601. Call up and tell us
now,
if
Paul,
you're thinking or not.
Did Plato start the Academy or Aristotle, this famous Greek school?
Plato started the Academy, but
Aristotle was his student.
Well, that's true, but and Aristotle started the porch.
All right, that's right.
Yeah.
we're getting into Zeno. Didn't he have a philosophy of?
Now Zeno dealt with the paradoxes classically. You know, the classic one of the tortoise and the rabbit running the race. And the idea of the infinite regress, a better one in the philosophical terms is Diogenes the Cynic,
mm-hmm.
you know, who lived around the time of Alexander the Great, so he was a younger contemporary of Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
And of course Plato had long since gone into the Eleusinian fields. And he, of course, was like sort of a nihilist, sort of a Taoist character. You know, he lived in a tub, you know, an old wine cask, you know, which was his house just to keep out of the rain. You know, and one day he was out sunning himself, and Alexander the Great had just, you know, conquered the city he lived nearby, and Alexander had heard of this great philosopher, so he went up there and he stood in front of him. He says, I'm Alexander the Great. He says, yes, so what? You know, he says, I just conquered your city. He says, yeah, all right. You know, he says, I understand that you're Zeno the Great, you're Diogenes the Great, Diogenes the Cynic. You're the great, great philosopher. He says, what can I do for you? What would you like? He says, well, why don't you move out of the way? You're blocking my sun. You know, I want to get an even tan here. So, of course...
Everything is relative.
Yeah, so, of course, this is probably an apocryphal story anyway. This probably didn't really happen this way. And then, of course, Alexander said, well, if I were not Alexander, I would be Diogenes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We don't know what Diogenes said. Yes, we don't know what Diogenes said. But, you know, the classic saw was Diogenes ran around in Athens with a plucked chicken
right.
saying, this is Aristotle's man. So, you know, because that's what Aristotle said, that human beings were featherless bipeds.
Uh-huh.
So he figured, you pluck a chicken, you got a man.
Well, you know, where do you think all of this is going? You know, I'm always fascinated by the lineage of philosophical thinking, mm-hmm. how it started way back, you know, mm-hmm. 2,000, 3,000 years ago, people trying to come up what is real, what's reality, mm-hmm. you know, where are we going, what are we, all of the questions, but we're still there. And, of course, you've had all these great philosophers and thinkers that have had their ideas written down and continued, but they learned from each other, and they just keep adding on. So where are we now? I mean, who are the great philosophers today?
Well, we're going around now. One of the big things coming up now is, and I'm thinking about psychology more than philosophy, is the whole study of consciousness and the idea of a positive psychology, rather than a psychology aimed at defining malfunctioning.
Yeah. There's actually been a lot of work done on the psychology of health,
mm-hmm.
and you know what health is, and they've done a, there's been a lot of interesting clinical mm-hmm. and theoretical work done on that thing of defining what psychological health is.
One of the things that has come out, really, is the ability of the individual to actually change the physical structure of parts of his brain or her brain by the way they are behaving. And they've done this with the study of the Tibetan monks and their meditation. And that you don't have to do a whole lifetime of this. If you meditated 20 minutes a day for 6 months, you would actually change parts of your frontal cortex. Physically.
I can believe that.
So then what I guess what's interesting to me is whether people feel like, yes, they can make choices, yes, they can change, or as you so frequently hear, there's nothing I could do about it. I had no choice. I had to do this. I had to do that. There's no point in trying to improve anything because this is the way it is.
We're sort of locked in this realm.
Exactly.
Well, one therapeutic, one way that this is approached that has some benefits is teaching people to tell their story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about a determinate story. I did this because this was done to me, and mm-hmm. I had no other available choices. I saw things in this limited way. There was this either and that or, and mm-hmm. there was nothing in between or nothing otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Just this or that, and both were bad, and both harmed me or harmed another, mm-hmm. and I was stuck, and I couldn't do anything about it.
But is everything that black or white?
Well, you see, this
is
the thing.
Right, I know. I think we live in a world of gray.
But you see, but
shades of gray.
But here's the thing. Well, but you're getting into this situation, of course. What you asked the person to do is, okay, that was true for you then, and you did what you did then. Now, think over it again and think, are there other alternatives?
Mm-hmm.
Can you otherwise tell the story?
Mm-hmm.
Can you bring in factors that you weren't aware of then that mm-hmm. that might have contributed to a different deliberation?
Right.
You know?
Well, that would go back to knowledge. The more knowledge one would have, then the more creative they could become doing things a different way.
But what you're also giving a person the opportunity to do is by looking at their own life story, you're saying that you can change it now.
Yes.
That you're not a prisoner of your choices. That now that you know better, you can look back at yourself and say, well, this is what I did then because I didn't know this. But this is what I know now, therefore I am no longer as imprisoned by those consequences as I was.
It's also the recognition that what you do is a choice. It is a choice, and you are responsible for the consequences of that choice, and that's something people don't want to accept as well.
I was always fascinated by the quote by the famous Greek historian Thucydides,
mm-hmm.
who wrote A History of the Peloponnesian War,
mm-hmm.
which was the great Greek war between Athens and Sparta.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in that war, and then afterwards, I think he wrote a history of it, but
mm-hmm.
he was considered the greatest Greek historian.
Socrates was, too, who was
Socrates
Plato's mentor. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Thucydides wrote that knowledge is power. Now, listen mm-hmm. to this. Mm-hmm. He said, knowledge is power. It leads us to the correct decision and the right direction to mm-hmm. take. Now, if you think about that, if you have the knowledge to do something, and it'll make it able to be done. You see what I'm saying? If you know how to fix a car, you can go fix the car. If you know how to build something that can fly from here to the moon, that's power. Knowledge is power. If you know how to do brain surgery, then you're able to do it.
But nobody has that knowledge until they start trying something new.
Exactly.
Because there's somebody within the last 10 years or so actually got a Nobel Prize for their study, and I think it was a study of Wall Street, financial decision-making. But the underlying thing was that human beings are constantly making decisions based on insufficient information. So
the Greeks couldn't do brain surgery, but can now.
Well, that's actually not true. The Greeks did do, but there was trepanning taking place, which is where you cut open the skull to relieve pressure on the brain.
You see that in the Incas.
And the Incas did it, yeah.
As well.
Well, then we go to the lineage of adding on the knowledge to today's world.
Hopefully we do a little better than that, yes. Well, they live too. I mean, they put little bronze plates in their heads afterwards. But the point being here is that we never have sufficient knowledge.
Uh-huh.
We have, good enough knowledge, or maybe good enough
for here
knowledge.
And now,
yeah, and you do the best you can with what you have.
Exactly.
And that's part of the way, when you retell your story, you're caught in that, that dilemma, and you only saw everything was bad, and you couldn't change anything,
mm-hmm.
and you existed that, and you feel guilty about whatever it is you did or didn't do. The thing is when you're retelling the story, you retell it in a way that allows you to see that there were alternatives. Well, I didn't know the alternatives then, but I know there were alternatives. I know there are alternatives now.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows me a freedom to forgive myself, among mm-hmm. other things, for being caught in this situation. Mm-hmm. And I can see the reasons why I could only see it this either-or
right.
way. And speaking of either or,
I think forgiveness is a very key word there.
Well, I mean, there are two. We're going to focus on today was the continental philosophers, beginning with Kierkegaard
mm-hmm.
and Nietzsche.
Let me jump in there to say, everybody, you're listening to WCOM LPFM 103.5 on your radio dial and call in. Jump in. Don't be afraid that you're not being polite.
Yeah, that's this sophomoric...
it's not sophomoric. It's
this
very
sophomoric conversation
intellectually
can, yes.
philosophical. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, okay. When existentialism was identified in the 1920s, and became and was an issue was arising as a unique philosophical view, and it specifically emphasized that it basically was insisting that the concrete world we knew, the scientific world method, the scientific world, and the body of knowledge that what we would call science, which was all existence, existential, did not necessarily prove this. Platonic view of the world, or for that matter, even the Aristotelian correction of the Platonic view of the world. Things didn't seem to be changed from what we thought they were. We changed things by physically manipulating the world. So it sort of seemed like the world controlled our thoughts rather than our thoughts controlling the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this one view, and this is a very general view. So when they went back, there were two philosophers that the generation before, or could couple generations before World War, and this came out of basically the incredible depression that everybody felt, the collapse after World War I. Existentialism was mm-hmm. a result of the traditional values failing people individually and institutionally, and with the incredible depression and lack of nerve that people felt after World War One, we basically...
The existential vacuum.
Yes. So before, there were two philosophers who had been studiously ignored by the Academy. And that was Soren Kierkegaard, who was writing in Dutch. And he was a wonderful naysayer. I mean, he was, you know, he was, in other words, and he what he did is he railed against the dominant German language philosophy of his time, who was the lion of Berlin, Hegel. And if there's anybody, and Hegel was intoxicated with the mind and with thinking and with a sense of consciousness, as sort of omnivorous, cognitive, growl. It was like this big vacuum cleaner. Consciousness was a vacuum cleaner, sweeping all of existence into its maw and stirring it up, you know, into new theses and antitheses. And Hegel represented this this sort of incredibly dynamic and powerful philosophy that he tried. And, you know, and what Hegel did to philosophy is kind of hard to know because we take for granted. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Hegel was really just riding the coattails of Kant. Mm-hmm. Kant, who is the true father of modern philosophy, though Descartes is called the father of modern philosophy, it was Kant's constructive critiques, critique of whatever it is,
but
pure reason.
We're moving away from Cartesian thought.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. We've been moving away from Cartesian thought for 150 years.
Yeah.
But we haven't quite got there yet.
Right, right.
And mainly because we tend to still... We still tend to be dominated by dualistic formulations.
And then just to jump in with an answer to who are our philosophers today, are physicists. You listen
you
to...
You think so,
absolutely.
Audrey? You think it's the physicist? Well, it seems that everyone out there in philosophy, in physics, particle physics, astronomy, everyone seems to be trying to search for the truth.
Mm-hmm.
What is the truth? You know, what is the answer to these questions we have? But
I noticed that Pontius Pilate said that to Jesus, but what kind of what answer did Jesus give?
All right, what was the answer, Paul?
I was asking you.
Oh, you're asking me. Probably love is the answer, and forgiveness. But
I don't think that was said at his trial.
Probably. I know what you're saying,
that
but that was what he was trying to maybe convey. But
I was asked in a seminar one time to write what message would, one of the things, a message I would like to leave to people I cared about and about living their lives. And my message, part of it was, may they always search for truth and never find it.
Well,
because as soon as you think you have found the truth, you automatically turn into some insufferable being who makes people suffer.
You know, Socrates used to walk around
like my
Athens.
Name.
Didn't Socrates walk around Athens and ask people, you know, these tough questions like, what is truth? What is justice?
Mm-hmm.
What
mm-hmm.
is beauty?
Yeah,
questions that really can't be answered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And when people thought they had answers and answered him, he would keep asking them questions.
Yes.
That's right.
So,
until they were completely mired in the absurdity of their understanding.
Well,
if
then
you
ever
read any of those Plato's dialogues, sometimes you want to take Socrates and shake him.
Exactly.
Like, oh, for heaven's sakes.
But Audrey, getting back to your statement,
right.
The only logical, intelligent answer I would think would be that the truth is very elusive.
Uh-huh.
It's relative, and it's always changing.
And that's thing
but
right
you
there.
See, that's
when,
the,
you
say those
that, descriptions. When you say
all
that
right.
truth is relative, then you get into the are. That's a whole question of are there any universals that hold true? So if you bring it down to something in our situation where the truth is it is a bad thing to kill somebody, and you get into another whole situation where, well, if that person is attacking you, or if it's not in a direct physical attack, that person is attacking your livelihood, then is it all right to kill them? Because it's relative. The
exactly.
truth is relative.
I mean, it's so a simple answer is you'll never have the answer. The answer is
well,
no.
Well, but you see, that's a regress of relativism.
Right, right.
And
mm-hmm.
the problem with regress relativism is that it gives you no moral stance by which to make a decision.
Right.
And so even with the existentialists who really agree that there was this profound relativity in existence, but the other side of relativity is interdependence.
Mm-hmm.
Everything interdepends. That's the other side of relativity, that everything is interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, relativity didn't come into fashion until Einstein sort of showed up and coined the term that made it more of a household word mm-hmm. and tied it in with science. And about 35 years ago, I read something by an author in Scientific American,
mm-hmm.
the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was saying, back then I used to teach science.
Mm-hmm.
And in that article, the author, who was a well-known professor at one of the famous universities in the country, brought out the fact that Einstein was basically copying Pythagoras with, A squared plus B squared equals C squared. And using that equation, Einstein, in doing E equals MC squared and tying his relativity theories into a nice little neat package, he basically was just copying Pythagoras and was sort of down on Einstein, saying maybe Einstein wasn't as great as we think he is.
Well, the other
maybe
the other
he built on it.
Right. There we go.
Well, that's a little kinder.
It's relative, the way you put it.
But there's another thing, too, about Einstein, is that the other thing he did is he went diametrically in the opposite direction of where normative physics was going at that point. In other words, normative physics was going in this other, moving in another direction, and he moved 180 degrees, mm-hmm. and formulated this thing. And formulating it in terms of the Pythagorean theorem. He didn't follow the Pythagorean theorem per se, but what he did is he expressed it in the language of mathematics, which was the acceptable way that physics talk to each other.
I think you're right.
And he came at a time, but he only now see his if he had come 10 years earlier. This is Polanyi, who's another great physicist, and was a contemporary of Einstein, and who actually had a version of the relativity theory of Einstein earlier than Einstein, which was rejected. Said very much so that if Einstein had came. He just so happened that his views came at the right time when even though it was the opposite of what everybody else was thinking, people were frustrated enough, there was enough accumulated evidence that the ways they were thinking about it weren't working,
mm-hmm.
that they wasn't explaining what the nature of reality is. Now, for instance, one of the bedrocks for the theory of relativity in Einstein is the uniformness of space,
mm-hmm.
that space is a uniform thing. We know from particle physics at this point that space is not uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the Einstein equations ultimately do not pan out because the constancy of the speed of light, which is one of the bedrocks,
right.
one of the things, is not demonstrable
mm-hmm.
in evidentiarily. We
mm-hmm.
don't know because of this of the bending
mm-hmm.
and the non-uniformity of space.
Mm-hmm.
But what that is, how that changes things, no one has really, that I know of, has come up with a serious
Paul,
answer.
That needs to be your next paper.
yeah, that's right. Well, I do think that, you know, of course, now the reason that they claim that, space isn't uniform is because space is a condition of matter. In other words, you have whatever this energetic flow is of particles and so forth, and atoms or whatever you want to call them, that energetic flow leaves a shadow, and that shadow is space. But what we don't know is, if you remove that energetic flow, what would that non-featureless space be? And we don't know what that is. But what we do know is it's sort of like there are ripples in nothingness that we haven't really quite figured out what they are yet. And of course, the major question is, and I see Einstein said that theoretically that photons didn't create any ripples in space. And, you know, I'm not enough of a particle physicist or even physicist to know if I'm making any sense at all.
Well,
right,
Paul,
now,
wasn't Einstein trying, and Audrey, wasn't Einstein trying to find one equation to answer the great question about the universe?
Universal field theory.
Where I think there are four known forces that we know of physically that regulate and control all things. Gravity, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and the electromagnetic force. Those are the four. But no one has been able to put the four of them together in one equation.
Well, even Einstein, as I said, was working with too few blocks. That there were things that hadn't been observed yet. That
one of those things which he ended up calling spooky action at a distance is the fact that affecting a molecule here, say in Carborough, again, you come up with your chaos theory, can actually change the action of a molecule on the continent.
Without there being a causal connection.
Exactly.
In other words, there are no visible links, dominoes leading to that
we
place.
We haven't found them yet.
Have either of you ever heard of this term called tachyons? Spelled, I think, T-A-Y-C-O-N-S.
Yeah, it's one of the particles that seem to travel backwards in time.
Exactly. In other words, our realm, we're in this realm of light being a kind
Well, we're in a space-time continuum.
Right, our space-time continuum.
Which is created by the so-called stability of matter that we exist in.
Okay, let's bring this all down to how we make decisions and our ability to choose and change, and how does it affect our view of how we live our lives? Or does it?
I think it does, but I think we're more influenced in how we view our lives and how we live our lives by our immediate surroundings and the world that we're in.
In other words, our friends and their demonstrative freedom and reactivity, which in reactivity would be acting without deliberation, without choice. And the collectivity of the people we hang out with, or the communities we live in, who exist within that, are the ways that we are the ways that govern our ability or our understanding to the degree that we can make choices and
does
change.
Does that create a conditioned mind?
It's a conditional mind.
We're all classically conditioned by our world around us.
But the ability sometimes to distance yourself as best you can,
you have that
from
ability.
That conditioning.
Who would be a pragmatist?
A deconditional mind.
I tend to try to live practically, do things in a practical way.
But practicality here is recognizing the conditions that you think of as normative and actuary.
Well, who would be a famous pragmatist in today's world?
John Dewey? He's been
Hillary Clinton.
Well, you know, John Dewey, the educator,
right?
You know what his famous little quote was? Remember I was talking about it when you and I were talking earlier, Paul. John Dewey said that most of the time we never solve our problems. Mm-hmm. We simply outgrow them. Think about
that. If we're lucky.
That's developmental, yes, yes. Well, was
well
it was,
between a pragmatist and an opportunist.
I got a kick out of as the basis of what Max Weber said, that human beings were animals who lived in a world of meaning that was mostly of their own creation.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
How much do you think things have really changed?
But you see, the thing is, I think we're human beings who live in a world of meaning, which is mostly the creation of those people around us. You know, and so we're more reflective of the, you know, of our conditions than we are projective of our own desires.
And so that's
but I think
where
they're both going
either
on.
You are an actor. Uh-huh. Or a reactor. And of course we are all at
we do
both,
both
at different times.
Yeah.
But what predominates? How do you see yourself as being someone who is actually a co-creator of the world?
I think that depends on your age.
It can be influenced by your age.
Again, everything's relative. We keep going in circles here. Mm-hmm. A 10-year-old kid, is he going to be active or reactive compared to a 50-year-old man?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, let's face it, a 10-year-old kid, in terms of your Dewey thing, doesn't have the brain yet to be non-reactive.
Exactly. That's why this discussion is always so interesting.
Well, it's a matter of reaching a point where you understand your limitations and your freedom, what degree of freedom you have to work within those limitations.
Yeah, and of course, and you know, this is where the thing with Nietzsche. And Nietzsche is really, he is a wonderful philosopher to read when you're about 16 or 17 years old, and you've read a little philosophy already. In other words, it always helps to have read a little Kant and maybe mm-hmm. read a little a Descartes, know a little Plato and a little Aristotle. You don't have to master them all.
I got my philosophy from Shakespeare.
Yeah, but you know, you read all of those people. And then when you read Nietzsche, you recognize that they're all missing the boat.
Well, now, didn't, you know, years ago in the 60s, freshman college students, I think, had to read Sartre and Albert Camus, The Stranger.
Right.
Uh-huh. And those fellows were pretty much just copying Nietzsche.
Well, what they were doing, in some ways, they weren't as effective as Nietzsche, because Nietzsche was a better writer than they were, for the most part. And in the sense, that's why they went back and they rechristened Nietzsche, and they rechristened Kierkegaard as existentialists, though mm-hmm. at the time that they were writing and living, they were just really arguing against the establishment quasi-normacy of the ideas around them, which they saw as patently, depriving people of their true freedom and choice, and rather imprisoning them in conventionality.
I want to go over.
And no teenager should be imprisoned by conventionality. Go out there and get them tats, everybody. Everybody's got tats.
It's surprising when
get them piercings, man. Get them piercings.
When spring and summer, the warmer weather comes, and all of a sudden all these decorations, body decorations, are revealed.
Mm-hmm.
I want to give us a few minutes here to talk briefly about. This is shared ideas of existential therapy and therapists. One, existence is verb-like. In other words, it is active, it is changing, and we do influence it. Existence is freely choosing. You have the ability, and I would throw in the responsibility of being aware of choosing. Existence as towards the future. It draws on the past, acts in the present, and moves towards the future.
Unless you're dominated by tachyons.
Yes, absolutely. And whether you're looking at it and seeing waves or dots,
yes,
then you go to an optometrist.
This is obviously a tacky conversation.
existence is limited. And Heidegger talks about thrown-ness. In other words, this is, and this way you get your existential angst, your anxiety, your worry, your understanding that you're thrown into the world. You're not given any kind of guidelines or books except by what you hopefully get some helpful hints from your parents, but sometimes you don't. But there's no diagram from on high. You're thrown into this world, and as you said earlier, Rocco, you do the best you can. And this, we know we're going to die. That's another thing that the existentialists like to remind
us. But most of
us
don't think much about it.
No, at the beginning of something that I'm working on, it's like we put death behind us. You know, we just go towards our death walking backwards because we don't want to look at it. But it's something that creates the anxiety, is the fact that life is limited. We're thrown here, we don't know what's going on, and we're going to be out of here, and we still don't know what's going on.
That's what I mean. The great questions never seem to be solved and get answered completely.
And we have to remember that in terms of what philosophers do, and we are talking about people who are usually identified as philosophers, is one of the things they do is they reinvent how to ask the question,
right,
so that it has a significance towards discovery.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, the questions aren't actually meant to be, you know, patently answered.
Right.
They're meant to be reinvestigated so that one can move towards discovery.
That's the whole point of Socratic questioning.
Right. But if you carry it,
which,
another,
by the way, Socrates did not do very well.
Apparently. Which, if you carry that further, if you look at it, getting back to relativity, in this manner, where you have the truth, whatever the truth is, if it is whatever, it doesn't matter what you think, what you believe, what you do, it isn't going to change the truth. Believe whatever you want out there and do whatever you want, but it really isn't going to change the truth about the universe, what is, what isn't. All of these questions are, in other words, all of these answers we're seeking, what is the truth is just there. And we can only just sort of dance around it, but we really can't change it.
So then we get into the idea.
But that's a non-relative position, though.
Exactly.
We start thinking then about people's definitions or ideas about God. Is the truth, and what you were just describing, can you transfer truth and God as some super humongous intelligence, say, or awareness or consciousness that we can never quite...
That is.
But, you know, in German, you know what God's called, right? Gott. I got this. I got that. So the question is, oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Paul, what I'm saying is that we can believe anything we want and rephrase and reword all these things, as you're saying, Paul, but we're not going to change what is.
And we're
what
not
is,
know
is
what
there,
is.
And probably not know what is.
Exactly.
And that's as long as we're in this realm of this human nature realm that we are all a part of because we're human beings. Mm-hmm. That's all.
So then that's our ability to be to attain some sort of satisfaction and contentment in life perhaps has to deal with or is influenced strongly by our ability to deal with ambiguity and not knowing.
Because we're part of this realm that we're locked into but can change more so than other creatures that are alive. Mm-hmm. And let's take, I have a cup of water here. Mm-hmm. There's probably amoebas and parameciums in that water floating around right now.
Mm-hmm.
Can they comprehend New York City?
Right.
I don't think they can because...
Or even the water that they're swimming in.
Maybe, because that's not part of their realm.
Uh-huh.
Now, our realm is bigger and much more than the amoeba or paramecium in that water, but can we, you know, have all the answers that we see?
Can we really appreciate the environment on Venus?
Uh-huh.
which would be toxic to us life-wise, right. But, you know, but would still, could we really understand what that weather is like, you know, of noxious gases?
Or the realm of tachyons, where you have people out there that are studying and trying to figure out this other realm where a tachyon is supposedly a particle that can't ever go as slow as the speed of light, but can only go faster. Some people are thinking and believing that the only way we'll be able to go faster than the speed of light is to jump this realm into the tachyon realm, and there everything goes faster than light, if it exists.
In our last two minutes before Tobin comes in, we have choice, and are we capable of change?
We have choice, but it may be more apparent than real. However, that does not mean that one should act as if one does not have choice.
And recognizing choice, then we are responsible.
And again, our responsibility may be more apparent than real. And
folks,
so in other words, blame your appearance.
Audrey, I want to thank you for having me on.
I want to thank you. This has been great.
180 degrees away from music hall,
yes.
You know, where I keep things pretty simple. You
well,
know.
You know, we you all know,
here's
we
Tony
all need...
Bennett, and here's Frank Sinatra, and here's
and
Nelson
And you have
Riddle.
Your choice. And we all thank heaven we need you, Rocco, right now.
That's true, because without a little bit of music, life wouldn't be a song.
There you go. Well
and
said.
And with that, people, we are signing off. Counselor's Cafe will be up next week on Monday, and heaven only knows what will be happening then, but tune in. Write down 929-9601, please, and keep it in your mind to give us a call and get involved in these fantastically deep and engaging conversations. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Rocco. Stay tuned for Tobin Logan coming up next with readings, and enjoy the gorgeous day outside.